ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Imagine if your workplace conversations were recorded and made public.
You're off with the fairies with
Tell me where I've been off with the fairies during the show.
I don't have to prove anything.
No, you do. You can't accuse me of doing something
Listen to the program. You'll hear yourself.
Oh, no, just give me one example.
Be aware of what's really going on.
I am, Kyle. I totally am offended by you saying something like that.
Well, too bad.
That's radio hosts Kyle and Jackie O in an on-air exchange that appears to have ended their working relationship. If you've ever been in a situation like this, you understand that whatever happens, it's sad and can be messy. But for our purposes, this is a case study to explore the psychosocial hazards at work obligations, and to have recordings of actual workplace conversations is truly unique. Hello, I'm Lisa Leong on ABC Radio National's This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. You may not even know or care about this two-decade radio partnership and its ultimate breakdown. But what can you learn from this, whether you're an employer, a person in a similar circumstance, or a manager dealing with a complaint? Martin Campbell is a work, health and safety consultant and the former chief executive of state regulator SafeWork SA. Welcome, Martin.
Morning, Lisa.
Faye Calderoni is an employment lawyer and partner at Hall & Wilcox. She's also the author of Broken to Safe, Tackling Toxic Workplace Cultures and Burnout. Welcome, Faye.
Good morning, Lisa.
Faye, you've looked at only the court documents that show alleged evidence of Jackie O's side of the complaint. Mm. This is going to the federal court on the 24th of April. And at the time of this recording, we don't actually know how ARN is going to defend the case. What's your summary of the situation from an employment law point of view?
We are dealing with independent contractors in the workplace. Under our laws, our state safety laws, they are workers, regardless of the fact that they are not employees. They have obligations in relation to the work health and safety of each other and others in the workplace. And likewise, CBC, which is the person conducting the business we're undertaking in this studio, has obligations to ensure a safe work environment. In terms of the Fair Work Act context and, you know, what we call broadly employment claims, there is no unfair dismissal protection for Jackie in this case or for any contractors. What there is, however, are provisions in the Fair Work Act which protect someone that has asserted a workplace right from termination of their engagement or any other adverse action being taken against them because they have asserted that workplace right. Now, by virtue of these alleged complaints that Jackie made, she exercised a workplace right, and her lawyers also raised breach of the work health and safety obligations and indicated that they might make or they could make an application to the Fair Work Commission for orders to stop the bullying, which contractors can also bring.
All right, Martin, so as a refresher, what would you say are the key themes of the psychosocial hazard obligation in work health and safety laws?
The work health and safety laws were amended in 2023 to specifically include psychosocial safety. Now, the reality was they were always included in the work health and safety law in any event. They were part of the HBIT, the health of OHS, but the reality is employers and regulators didn't really take a lot of notice, and the regulators didn't enforce it. Everyone was focusing on physical safety. So the elevation in 23 really shone a light on what those hazards are. And to put a bit of detail around the duty, Safe Work Australia, who sets the national policy for work health and safety, created a code of practice which identified 14 specific hazards. That's now expanded to 17. But the 17 hazards are grouped really into three pillars. There's things around organisational culture, there are things around processes and systems, and then there are behaviours. And for the first time in safety, really, those 17 hazards cross over the disciplines of work health and safety, industrial relations and HR. So if you approach those 17 hazards from just one of those disciplines, you're probably going to set yourself up to fail. It really needs all three to come together to tackle them. There are several duties in the Work Health and Safety Act. The primary duty of care is for the business entity to provide a safe system of work. That includes physical safety and psychosocial safety. Psychological safety, that ability to feel free to raise issues without fear of retribution or humiliation, is part of psychosocial safety. Psychosocial is much broader. So the duty on the business is to look after people's mental health and well-being as much as physical injury. And the process there is the business has to identify all of the hazards. It has to try and eliminate them. And if they can't eliminate them, to reduce them to a level that's reasonably practicable. Now, some of those hazards are workplace aggression and violence, bullying, harassment, which includes sexual harassment and discrimination, poor organizational justice, and poor conflict and workplace interactions. So when you look at some of those specific hazards, they map across or potentially map across multiple aspects of this situation. So the duty is on the business to remove those or control them. But then there's a separate duty, which is on officers. So the duty on officers is a duty on the senior leadership of the organization. And that duty is to ensure the business has a system to do that. So the business needs a system. It's got to identify where those 17 hazards interact throughout the work that they do. It covers not only people who are employed in the conventional sense, it includes the definition of worker is much broader. It includes contractors, subcontractors, visitors, and other people. And then the duty on officers is to make sure that system is in place and the controls to eliminate those hazards are working as intended. And if leaders aren't doing that, then that's an individual liability on them. You can't insure against it. The organization can't pay your fine. Work health and safety breaches are criminal offenses. So if you breach your officer duties, it's a criminal prosecution and a criminal conviction. And some recent case law shows penalties in the region of sort of $20,000 to $200,000. So I always say to leaders and executives, if you are charged with a breach of your officer's duties and you are convicted, how do you go back home to your loved one to say that I've been convicted of a criminal offence because I didn't care for someone's mental health and well-being and we have a fine of $100,000? Most people don't have that lying around. So you're really selling assets, remortgaging properties to pay a penalty.
Now, Martin, so much in that. I mean, the main gist is it sounds like you have to be proactive about this. You're not waiting for someone to raise something and make a complaint.
Definitely, definitely. So the duty is to be proactive, not reactive. You've got to take the bull by the horns. In this situation, the duty would be on the organisation to provide that safe system of work. And if people complain to leadership about poor behaviours or poor systems and people's suffering from a mental health perspective, the duty is to react to that. If your worker makes a complaint and says this is not right, the expectation from a regulator is that you address that and you fix it. And if you don't, then that's a potential issue. But more importantly, there are three categories of prosecution in the work health and safety legislation. And the most serious one is a recklessness offence. So if the organisation knows that the risk exists and that risk is reasonably foreseeable and they don't do anything about it, then that's much more serious and the penalties are much more severe.
Martin, as a former safety regulator, what particularly stands out to you in this case study?
This is publicly known and it's publicly available. And from an evidence perspective, you rarely get that. In some respects, it makes it a walk-up start to investigate because it's very easy to see where your prima facie case is. Whilst this current situation with Jackie Owen Kyle is in the Fair Work and looking at the contract issue, the Safe Work investigation is separate but can run concurrently. So, and Safe Work don't need a complaint to start that process. They have the powers to do it themselves and they have the power to enter workplaces. They have the power to seize documents. They have the power to interview people. So when I was a regulator, I instigated an investigation. I mean, many people would know the infamous Adelaide Crows camp many years ago. I instigated an investigation into that without a specific complaint from any of the footballers. It was more that there was so much public information available that it gave me an indication that something wasn't right, and that was enough for me to trigger an investigation. There's nothing stopping Safe Work New South Wales doing the same here.
When you look at this case study, how could an organisation put controls in place to deal with a situation like this, to manage psychosocial risk?
Yeah, this is the most difficult aspect of the whole scenario. Organisations have been very used to physical injury, so you can buy PPE, you can put a guard on something, barricade it, but the psychosocial controls are around processes, systems and people. So how do you put a control around a person to stop them being aggressive, disruptive, bullying, etc.? So the controls for psychosocial safety is different to physical. What organisations will probably find is they've already got some in place, but in situations like this where people are verbally abusive, aggressive or bullying, those controls will generally look like code of conduct, code of values. There'll be some form of performance management process with clear lines of escalation for potential investigations and breaches. So it's important for organisations to have those in place, but it's also important to make sure that they are legally correct and you follow them. And following them is really important because when I was a regulator, I used organisations' policies and procedures against them. So if you've got a good one, but you don't follow it, that's an issue. And if you've got a bad one and you're following it, just as big an issue. So it's really important for organisations to do a risk assessment, and that's what the legislation requires.
Martin, someone like Kyle might actually argue, look, I've always spoken like this, I've always behaved like this. In fact, I've been rewarded and recognised for this behaviour. Why is it a problem now? So what's your answer to that?
Well, and that's a great question. And for me, it comes back to organisational culture and leadership culture. So the standard you walk past is the standard you accept. And just because somebody brings in a lot of money, sells a lot of widgets, or brings in a lot of listeners, doesn't mean that unacceptable behaviour is tolerable. So leaders need to look at the organisational culture and the leadership culture that they demonstrate, because everyone will be watching. And if people see that that behaviour is tolerated and even encouraged to some respect, then I guarantee you what you'll have in a broader sense is a psychologically unsafe work environment where people will be frightened to raise issues in fear of retribution.
Last year, there was a case in Victoria. Tell us about that.
Frost was an employee of Victoria Ambulance Service. Now, Frost was the court documents describes a prickly individual, but generally just disruptive. He wouldn't say good morning to people. He was rude, disrespectful. People would say hello to him. He would grunt, ignore him. So there was nothing overtly bullying or nasty about the behaviour. He was just generally a difficult person, and everyone knew that. And people accepted that. The leadership accepted that. But he was particularly disrespectful to women, and eventually complaints went into the regulator and investigation followed. But the commissioner in the Fair Work Commission who heard that case said that that low-level disrespectful behaviour is a work health and safety risk, and it is a psychological safety risk that organisations need to address. Now, ultimately, there was compensation paid out to those involved, but the message from that story at Frost is it doesn't have to be the big ticket, sensational, fanfare type poor behaviours that we expect. It can be low level poor behaviour over a long period of time. And I think back to my workplaces and organisations, and there's so many people I've worked with who are just disrespectful, rude, prickly, and people ignore them. It's like, oh, that's just John in the corner. Leave him. He's always like that. Well, that's not acceptable, man. You've got to address it.
You're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National. I'm Lisa Leong, and we're talking about psychosocial safety at work using Kyle and Jackie O as a case study. My guests are Martin Campbell, former Chief Executive of Safe Work SA, and employment lawyer Faye Calderoni. Coming up later, what should you do when you get a complaint? Faye, How much of this case do you think will hinge on Kyle's alleged behaviour towards Jackie O and his on-air personality?
I think it's a problem that this conduct has occurred for so long. There is some suggestion that there was some scripts, or that this was sort of premeditated or pre-scripted engagements. I don't accept that based on sort of what we heard play out. But it's fair to say that there probably was work health and safety policies and procedures dealing with discrimination and sexual harassment and other inappropriate behaviours in the workplace, that as contractors, Kyle was covered and Jackie O were covered by those policies, that they were entitled to make complaints in accordance with those policies, and that there was an obligation to act in accordance with those requirements, to consistently and indiscriminately enforce those requirements. And there no doubt was provisions in the contract that enabled the organisation to do so. That's the only way you can manage the conduct of contractors in the workplace, which is, you know, a little bit more complicated than in an employment relationship where you can issue more lawful and reasonable directions and performance managers.
And Faye, in accordance with Jackie O's court documents saying that she complained initially in August last year and then we heard it blow up publicly in February, what do you think might have gone wrong with the processes, so the HR or management processes here, that we can learn from?
It is hard when you are dealing with someone that is perceived to be untouchable or valuable or otherwise, you know, difficult to manage, to address this conduct. And we do often see leaders who are really hamstrung either by, you know, sort of commercial arrangements or challenged by their capability in addressing these issues. I can't speak directly to what happened in this case, or in fact, if anything did or didn't happen, because we just don't know. But I can certainly say it's not unusual for these things to be challenging behind the scenes, but it's absolutely necessary that if you are on notice of a complaint, you are on risk and you must address it. And if you don't address it and conduct escalates or something serious happens, the consequences from a work health and safety point of view are criminal consequences, but also, you know, more broadly for the organisation, what happens to everyone else that's there? How do you stop that dysfunction perpetuating and others mirroring those behaviours?
Martin, what do you say to executives and board members about their potential liability if psychosocial hazards are not managed?
You can always just ignore it and wing it and let it fly, and you just run the risk that the regulator won't find out or won't catch you. That's a terrible strategy, and the courts have hammered people who've used that. The right way to do it is to start with a risk assessment, a psychosocial safety risk assessment. And the only way you can do that is by providing an ability for your workers to share how they feel. And if you have a psychologically safe work environment where people feel free to tell you, you probably already know it. The reality is most don't. So the ability to share has to be anonymous, and executives have to be comfortable to allow anonymous feedback on how people are feeling. That risk assessment will then identify the existing controls that you have in the organization against those 17 hazards. And then you've got to fill the gaps. But there's also a legislative requirement to consult with your workforce. So you have to ask your people how to help fix the problem. And the reality is, they're the people suffering. They're the people that understand at the core face what the challenges are. They'll probably have solutions themselves. The vast majority of us as human beings are wired to work and succeed. So people will be naturally working around the hazards, keeping their head down, doing what they need to do. But if you don't have that psychologically safe environment for people to raise problems, then the bullies and the squeakiest wheels will exist. And if leaders let that happen, then that's the standard and the behaviour that people will work to.
Martin, in the latest report from the state regulator, Safe Work New South Wales, it shows 20% of requests between July to December last year were for psychosocial hazards. Are you surprised by that?
I'm surprised it's not more, to be honest, Lisa. And I think what's happening over the last couple of years is as this topic ventilates and people become more aware of it, more people are saying, that's happened to me, or I'm going through that scenario now. So I'm expecting a steep increase in complaints around psychosocial safety. And don't get me wrong, psychosocial safety is not about letting people do whatever they want when they want, because that's chaos. It's actually the opposite. It's about having really clear, fair, professional rules and boundaries for people to work within in a respectful way. So you can still manage underperformance and manage bad behaviour, but in the right way. And the other topic as well is the workers' compensation schemes are generally no fault. So when people put claims in for psychological injuries, those claims are generally accepted in most cases. They are incredibly expensive compared to physical injuries. So when you look at Safe Work Australia data, the last data drop was, I think the average cost of a physical injury was about $58,000 and took 3 weeks to get back to work. The average cost of a psychosocial claim is hit $300,000 and it takes six times longer. So if you're a CFO and you're balancing the budget and you have two or three or four of those claims, I guarantee you it's going to impact your workers' comp levy incredibly, and you won't have budgeted for that. So there are multiple levers here at play. There's HR levers, there's industrial, there's workers' comp, and there's safety, and executives need to be across which ones they're pulling at what time. And for me, it all starts with culture, and then you work from there.
Martin, let's say you are a leader in an organisation and a complaint is escalated to you and you haven't actually proactively done the things that you need to do. What would you say is best practice in terms of handling that complaint?
So I think this is where the HR and the IR and the safety teams need to work collaboratively, because if you just do it from one perspective, you're probably not going to get it right. So you need to bring those functions together and ensure, first of all, the person complained is heard and that their complaint is listened to and received. Then depending on what the complaint is, we can put a trauma-informed, person-centric approach over the top of that. So you need to put some scaffolding and care around the individual, but then you need to work with a HR team and do a thorough investigation to determine what are the contributing factors, what controls do we have in place, what went wrong. Throughout that whole process, particularly in things like bullying complaints, you need to apply procedural fairness to all people involved. So in this situation, the person being complained about should be told there's a complaint and that person should have a right to respond. But generally, from a practical point of view, when I'm doing investigations, that person would be the last person you speak to, because you need to speak to everybody else. And again, if people are psychologically unsafe, you need to give them the ability to raise issues and flag it. And a lot of the psych investigations I've done over the last few years, most people don't feel comfortable to put their name to a statement or a document. They're happy to talk anonymously and tell you the bad things that's got going on, but they're just fearful of putting the name to something in case they get sacked or the career ends or the contract's terminated.
Faye, do you have anything to add?
It really is a case study about how workplace law, workplace health and safety obligations, power and tolerance for bad behaviour really collide. And if you strip away all the noise, it's just a familiar legal problem that employers and leaders deal with every day. And, you know, how you discharge your duty to ensure safe and respectful workplaces, and frankly, the risks of acting too late.
And Martin, what is your message, I guess, to all of us?
Not to bury heads, do the risk assessment, create an environment where people can speak freely. Don't sweat on the results. If the results are really bad, then you know you've got a fair bit of work to do. But that's your baseline, and then progress from there. Worst thing you can do is just leave it.
Thank you so much, Martin.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And thank you, Faye.
Thanks, Lisa.
Faye Calderoni is an employment lawyer and partner at Hall & Wilcox. Her book is called Broken to Safe. Martin Campbell is a work health and safety consultant and the former chief executive of Safe Work SA. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It was produced by Michelle Weeks on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. If you'd like to hear more from us, you can like or subscribe to our show on ABC Listen or anywhere you get your podcasts. And you can share the love as well. Send it to a friend or colleague you think would enjoy this working life as much as you. I'm Lisa Leong, and until next time, work it like a charm.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.